Nice to see you all here. Exciting, isn't it? Just starting on this journey together. And how's this? If somehow the sound doesn't carry, there were some times that it didn't before, just raise your hand in the back if you can't hear. Start of a retreat is like we're all going on a journey together, and it's a journey that takes courage, and commitment, and patience and kindness, and we're all here to support each other in doing that, because especially this retreat where everyone has practiced some before, you don't have to be convinced that this is a good thing to do. It's always a treat to share with people who've had experience on their own, and they're not just trusting a friend and or something they read in a book, or saying, well, maybe I'll just try this out. You already know, oh, there's something to this. And you've heard the call, and probably it's too late to turn back. As one Tibetan master has said, the spiritual journey is fraught with perils and dangers and all kinds of challenges, and so one should consider carefully before embarking on it. But once started, it's best to finish. So it's too late now. And here we are supporting each other on this very profound, exciting, inspiring, challenging, worthwhile journey. And a few opening comments just in general about doing a retreat, and then I want to more specifically go into the theme of this retreat, awakening joy. First, some comments about in general practice, and that is you'll get, the way I see it anyway, exactly the retreat that you need. You cannot fail at this experience. Isn't that a comfort? All you need to do is show up and see what life has in store for you, what life is presenting you. You took the refuges earlier this evening, and taking refuge in the Dharma, the way I see taking refuge in the Dharma, is the understanding that in every moment, life is giving us just what we need to wake up. If it's a challenging moment, this deepens our courage and our inner strength and our compassion. And if it's a delicious, beautiful moment, this is a blessing. And as you'll hear me say throughout this week, don't miss it. Every moment, however, is here as a gift of life to wake up to. And the refuge in the Buddha that you took earlier is really an understanding that you have just what you need to wake up. You have this capacity, the same potential that the Buddha had to see clearly. You have all the goodness and the wisdom and the qualities that are going to take you through this journey, and you just are learning to water them and deepen them and help them grow. And here we are, refuge in the Sangha, we're all doing this together. And so, just a comment that, to remind you probably what you already know, that there will be some ups and some downs. If it's all up, please speak to me. I want to find out what's going on in there. If it's all down, well, you'll learn a lot. But chances are there'll be moments on both ends. And I just want to remind you something that I find very helpful, that it's not about trying to make any particular thing happen or arriving at a destination. It's about being here for the ride. Just learning to be here for the ride of this retreat, which helps us learn to be here for the ride of life. While I think of it, before I say more, I want to, I've been here, you know, as probably most of you know, teaching a weekend, which just finished. So I feel like I've been in this mode, and I've settled into this retreat center and this community. But I just realized this is a new community, and there's a few people that have carried over, but it's a whole new room full of people. And I wanted to express my appreciation to Tovana and to the people who invited me here. Ron Alon, who's been such a really great support, the managers and the staff and the cooks, and it's a real delight also to be having a new teaching team. It was a great one that we just had, and from what I hear, this is just as high a caliber with Ella and Yahel. So I'm looking forward to this new part two of this adventure. Okay, so back now to the retreat. Just the retreat that you need. And as probably you know or remember, it takes a little while to settle in. And so having some sleepiness or restlessness or aches in the body or busy mind, the first couple of days aren't usually so much fun. So you might just think, well, this is an awakening joy retreat. Let's get the goodies. Be really patient with your process. You don't have to make anything happen. You just, as they say, show up and see what life has here for you. And we'll do what we can to create the supportive conditions for you, whether it's talks or check-ins with groups or individual meetings, instructions. But mainly it's you discovering for yourself all the facets of being human. And I often think of it as one big part of the process is making friends with ourselves. And then as we see who we really are, then we can develop those beautiful qualities and share them with the world. Okay, so now I want to talk a bit about this theme, awakening joy. And I want to just acknowledge coming to Israel. I haven't been here before this last week or so, in 22 years. In 1996, I came and taught a retreat at Ein Karam. And it's been a while since I've been back, and part of the reason that I wanted to come back after I was invited by Muli, who's somewhere in this room, was I wanted to see what life is like here in Israel and share my approach to practice, not my only aspect approach to practice, but an important part of practice, which is seeing this as a path that brings great well-being and happiness, not just on the cushion, but that can hold all of the pain and the suffering and the tension and the stress of life wherever we are, but particularly when I think of Israel, I feel this is a place that can use as much joy as possible. And I must say, although I can read Hebrew, because I went to Hebrew school and I was bar mitzvahed, I can't understand more than three words. Abba, Ima, no, four, Lo, Kane. And so it's kind of returning to my roots, but it's also seeing seeing what's here right now. And if I have something to offer that can be useful, then that's that really makes me happy. So, awakening joy. I wrote a book and teach an online course on it. And I want to first share how I got into focusing on this. It was because after a very long honeymoon period where I fell in love with the Dharma and saw that it was a way out of my own suffering, and I had a fair amount of my own internal suffering. At some point, I became really serious about my practice. Dead serious about my practice. Emphasis on the dead. And I lost my joy. And for a while, I was kind of disconnected from that place in me that just naturally, it's just part of my temperament, can be very passionate about things, can love to celebrate and play, and loves life. And somehow I misinterpreted some teachings, not conceptually, but deep down in my being, to somehow feel that it wasn't quite okay to feel my aliveness, and that if I'm a good Buddhist, I'm equanimous and very spiritual and not a whole lot of fun. So at some point, I realized this isn't really me. And I saw the practice is really connecting with what our true nature is. And I wanted to take a look and see what the Buddha had to say about happiness and joy. Because there's the Four Noble Truths, there's suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's an end to suffering, and there's a path leading to the end to suffering. That's a lot of suffering. At least in the way that one can easily read and forget that the Buddha was called the happy one. So I said, what did the Buddha actually say about happiness? And I found that I was not alone in this, and also that there are teachings, maybe I'll just share with you a little bit about some teachings where this can be, this view can be distorted. So here's first a passage that I wanted to share from one of an inspiring teacher of mine, Ajahn Sumedho, who's who's the senior Western monk in Thai Theravada Buddhism. He was Ajahn Chah's first student. Jack Kornfield, if you know his name, he was Jack's kind of elder brother, and founded all of the a tremendous network of monasteries. But this is what Ajahn Sumedho has to say. Sometimes in Theravada Buddhism, that's the way of the elders in Burma, Thailand, Sri Lanka, basically these days, sometimes in Theravada Buddhism, one gets the impression that you shouldn't enjoy beauty. If you see a beautiful flower, you should contemplate its decay. Or if you see a beautiful woman, you should contemplate her as a rotting corpse. This has a certain value on one level, but it's not a fixed position to take. It's not that we should just feel compelled to reject beauty and dwell on its impermanence and on how it changes to being not so beautiful and then downright repulsive. That is a good reflection on anicca, dukkha, and anatta, on impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and the selfless nature of reality. But it can leave the impression that beauty is only to be reflected on in terms of these three characteristics, rather than in terms of the experience of beauty. People who can't see the beauty of the good or the true are really bitter and mean. They live in an ugly realm where there's no rejoicing in beauty and goodness and truth. But once you have true insight, then you find you enjoy and delight in the beauty and the goodness of things, because truth, beauty, and goodness delight us. In them, we find joy. So I saw, oh, I'm not alone in this. And when I saw the misunderstandings that I had, I realized that there are many people who can get very serious about practice. In fact, let me just ask, how many people find that they sometimes get a bit too serious about practice? Okay. I'm glad I'm not alone. And if you, I mean, this is a very profound thing that we're doing. I don't want to just make it light and, oh, this is Dharma light. It's very profound. It's liberating. But if one gets somber and heavy in one's practice, then you lose the juice and the aliveness that can really keep you going, especially through the hard times. Here's a teaching I wanted to share. A couple of teachings that can show you just how this can be misunderstood, the purpose of practice. This is one quality that is very important to cultivate called samvega, S-A-M-V-E-G-A. This is a definition of samvega from Ajahn Tanasaro. The oppressive sense of shock, dismay, and alienation that comes with realizing the futility and meaninglessness of life as it's normally lived. A chastening sense of one's own complacency and foolishness in having let oneself live so blindly, and an anxious sense of urgency in trying to find a way out of the meaningless cycle.
Can you repeat?
Can I repeat? Repeat it again? Okay, I'll maybe go a little slower. And if you need, if you don't understand, and these are some big words, so I'll just clarify. The oppressive sense of shock, I'll act it out. Dismay and alienation that comes with realizing the futility. Futility, what would you say? Okay. And meaninglessness, you know that one, of life as it's normally lived. A chastening, a kind of hurrying sense of one's own complacency. Chastening is like, come on, you better get on with it. Is that it? Okay. Sense of one's own complacency and foolishness in having let oneself live so blindly, and an anxious sense of urgency in trying to find a way out of the meaningless cycle. You with me? You hear that and you say, gosh, let's get out of here as fast as we can. But the important words in that definition that sometimes you can miss, the futility and meaninglessness of life as it's normally lived. Doesn't mean that life is meaningless. It's just that what we usually think of as what the purpose of life is, what we're being told usually, is not really where happiness and fulfillment is to be found. So this is a very important understanding, but not to misinterpret and think, oh, life is meaningless and let's get out of here. Here's another important quality, profound understanding to open up to, that can also easily turn into seriousness. And this is the quality that's called, or the attitude or perspective that's called nibbida, N-I-B-B-I-D-A. I'm curious, how many people are familiar with nibbida? Okay, I want to get a sense of group. Nibbida is talked about as your attitude with regard to this mind-body process, the five aggregates, if you're familiar with in Buddhism. The five aggregates is another way of saying this mind and this body. Oh, good. You keep on interpreting. Yeah, okay. Where it says, one should abide in utter disgust for the aggregates. Fun, huh? That is, have utter disgust for this mind body. This is one translation from quite a while ago, Victorian English. Another translation, one should dwell engrossed in revulsion. What's revulsion? Do you know? That. Towards the aggregates, okay? Now, if you don't have that great a self-image to begin with, you know, oh yeah, I know it, that one. I've got utter disgust for this mind-body process. Oh, that's good. Keep on hating this body and this mind. But those are just poor translations for the word nibbida. A more accurate translation is, and you can, there's a beautiful essay by a great Buddhist scholar, Andy Olensky, about this, where he says, more accurately, nibbida is one should become disenchanted with regard to the aggregates. Disenchanted. Enchantment where you're under a spell, like that. And if you're under the spell of, wow, look at that body. Wow, look at this body. You're under the enchantment and the spell of this mind and body, particularly body. And he said, one should develop a disenchantment that is breaking the spell of being so enchanted by this package of who we are. That's very different than utter disgust and revulsion. But you can see why people can misunderstand and say, oh, I'm not supposed to like this body. I'm not supposed to let myself appreciate or enjoy other bodies and minds around. So I could see I wasn't alone in this. And what I wanted to see when I realized, wait a second, the Buddha was called the happy one, was what did he really have to say about happiness? The Dalai Lama, one of the great embodiments of Buddha Dharma, wrote a book, maybe you're familiar with, The Art of Happiness. And the first line in that book, the first sentence says, the purpose of life is to be happy. Just really take that in. The purpose of life is to be happy. Because when we find our own true well-being, true happiness, then all the beautiful qualities that life has given us can shine through without obstruction. And if we're busy saying, you know, oh, I'm not good enough, and oh, this is disgusting, and what a drag it is to be me, nobody is gonna get your beautiful qualities. You're busy blocking them. And so he says, find true happiness, and everybody benefits from that. So when I took a look at these teachings, I came across some teachings that really spoke to me as far as how to hold this profound Dharma in a way that in a very real sense can cultivate the well-being that's inside. And the Buddha has many, many words for well-being. There's piti, usually translated as rapture or bliss. There's sukha, often translated as happiness. Pamoja, gladness. There's words for contentment and peace and equanimity. All of those things, many, many flavors of well-being. And so just something to say from the outset, when you hear the word joy, don't let it trip you up. Some people hear awakening joy, give me a break. I'll take not being miserable. Thank you. Go for not being miserable. Start there. Oh, I'm not miserable right now. That's pretty neat. Okay. But when I am using the word joy, I'm saying it really to mean the whole range of qualities of well-being. It's just not as catchy to say awakening well-being as awakening joy. But that's what I'm speaking of. So whatever word, whatever flavor of many flavors resonates with you, just think of it in those terms. And most fundamentally, awakening true well-being inside. So I took a look, and there were three particular teachings that made sense to me that are really at the heart of seeing, for me, seeing this path as a path of happiness, and that will be we'll be working with as we go through this retreat together. One teaching is about wise effort. Now you might think, wise effort, that doesn't sound like a whole lot of joy. But actually, wise effort technically talks about four different aspects, two that have to do with unwholesome states, and two that have to do with wholesome states. In Pali, the words akusala and kusala. And akusala, unwholesome states, are states of suffering that are suffering in the moment and lead to more suffering as they're cultivated. States like greed, hatred, delusion, the big three, fear, judgment, envy, jealousy, lust, anger, outrage. All of those states are states of contraction. They're painful. There's an agitation in the mind and the heart. Not that they're wrong or bad, they're just part of being human. So, but he says, try to guard against these states from arising, and if they have arisen, learn how to overcome them. And we'll be doing lots of practice here. Part of the practice is learning how to work with unwholesome or painful states when they arise. Very important. Not to get rid of them or say, oh, I'm bad for having them, but just learning how to work with them so they don't overwhelm you. And then the other two aspects of wise effort are kusala, wholesome states. States like compassion, generosity, joy, peace, love. All of those states are beautiful states, states of opening and expansion of the heart. And they feel good in the moment, and they also feel good as they're cultivated. They lead to more happiness. And he says, third wise effort, to cultivate these states like mindfulness or loving kindness or compassion. He says this is a good thing to cultivate, and to maintain and increase those wholesome states when they've arisen. He says this is a good thing. When there is a wholesome state, it's good to maintain it and even increase it. Fourth wise effort. Now your mind might say, sounds like attachment to me. How many people had that thought? A couple? Okay. The tricky part is, if a wholesome state is here and we try to grasp it, please don't go away, or how do I make it even bigger? We've just turned it into an unwholesome state. Because wholesome states are states of expansion, and unwholesome states are states of contraction. But he does say to maintain and increase the wholesome state, not by trying to grab onto it and have any kind of attachment to it. So how can we do that? This brings us to our second principle. And he says, connected with a wholesome state, there's a feeling of gladness. There's a feeling of uplift that we experience in that moment. As an example, or I'll just actually have you think of an example. Go inside, close your eyes for a moment, and think of something that brings you joy. Some activity or some situation or whatever it is that brings you joy. And as you think about it, Remember the last time you were experiencing it. And even just now, as you recall it, notice how it feels inside. In your body, as well as your mind and your heart, how does it feel? Okay, you can open your eyes. Okay, just a few comments. What do you notice? What does it feel as you recall that? Could you just say a word to describe it? Could take a few comments.
Peace.
Peace. Okay. What else?
Gentle sensation in the body.
Openness. A gentle sensation of openness in the body. I'm not looking for any of the right answer. Just there's many. Yes.
Freedom.
Ah, yes.
Relaxation.
Relaxation. Yes.
Excitement,
yeah. Anything else that hasn't been said? Yes?
Like a buoyancy.
A buoyancy, yeah. So you notice just even in, did you have some?
Smile.
A smile in space right inside. So you see all of those are qualities of opening, and there's a kind of uplift, really sweet feeling. And he says that gladness, there's a feeling of gladness, what he calls gladness connected with the wholesome. And in one discourse, for those who are scholars and like to track these things, it's Majjhima Nikaya number 99. He says that gladness connected with the wholesome, I call an equipment of mind to overcome all ill will and hostility. I'll say it again. The gladness that's connected with the wholesome, I call an equipment of mind. It's like a really good tool in your toolbox to overcome all ill will and hostility. You know, you're feeling kind of bummed out, you've had a bad day, and all of a sudden something touches you that brightens you. Maybe you see some kids playing, or your dog comes up and greets you. And in just a moment, it dispels, it changes, it evaporates all the contraction inside. And he also says in this discourse that gladness, one gains inspiration in the meaning and in the truth, inspiration in the Dhamma. He says, this is a good thing. And in fact, in this same discourse, he gives the example of being generous. He says, if you're in the middle of a generous act, he says, think to yourself, oh, I'm being generous now. Not check it out and I hope everyone sees how generous I am. No, that's not what he's talking about. But he's saying, notice how good it feels for generosity to move through me. That's one example of that gladness. And he says, notice that gladness connected with the wholesome. And that is the way to maintain and increase the wholesome state by being very present for it. And usually we can miss it, or we tend to miss it, because we're often busy looking out for what can go wrong, for where the danger is. And it's a good thing that we're wired up that way. You know, you don't want to run out into the street when it's a red light. Or you want to be careful and aware when there's some danger. But we tend to overdo it. And this little almond-shaped cluster of neurons in our brain called the amygdala is continually scanning and looking for danger. And when we're stressed, it is that much more active. Have you ever noticed when you're stressed, it's really hard to be joyful? So he says, notice that gladness, but it takes practice. I came across one study that said, for every negative encounter, suppose somebody speaks sharply at you, for most people, it takes 7 positive encounters to kind of come back. People saying, oh, hi, nice to see you. 1. Until finally, ah, I'm kind of back again. But you can practice and not have the negative have such an impact and have the positive more easily touch us. My friend, maybe some of you have heard somebody who's become very famous in recent years, a man named Rick Hansen, who wrote a book called Buddha's Brain and Hardwiring Happiness. And he's a dear friend. And he says that the brain is like Teflon for positive experiences and Velcro for negative experiences. That's how it works for most of us. So the idea is to, when you're having a moment of well-being, to really be present for it. And Rick has a very good formula. He says, if you are having a moment of well-being, to take, if you can, 15 seconds to really be mindful of it and let yourself experience it. And his practice is, do that 6 times in a day. I know that's 90 seconds of well-being if you can handle it. Yeah. And if you do that over a 2-week period, you will start to notice a shift in your general level of well-being. 1, because you are deepening your neural pathways of well-being. And 2, because you're starting to get into the habit of looking for the good. So we have a whole week here. We're going to have a lot more than 90 seconds each day to cultivate it. And that leads to the third principle, the third teaching of the Buddha that has profound implications, where he says in Majjhima 19, for those scholars, he says, whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. Make sense? Whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, what your habit of mind is, that becomes the inclination of your mind. That's where your mind naturally lands. Modern neuroscience has another way of putting this, the axiom that says, neurons that fire together, wire together. That's how it works. The more you practice something, the more it becomes the way you see things. And we have what is also in neuroscience called a confirmation bias, where we tend to look for, or we tend to notice what our brain believes is so. And so, for instance, if you think that people are going to disappoint you, you'll find ample evidence to corroborate your theory, but you'll miss all the times that they don't. Or if you think, oh, humanity is just going down the tubes, there's no hope, all you have to do is click on hyperlink reality to say, yep, there it is again, there it is again, yep, there it is. But you'll miss out often on all the goodness around you. And if you think, oh, well, I know life is suffering, you know, you're born, you suffer, then you die. Life is a drag, or it's meaningless, that's what you'll notice. But if you look at another lens and see, oh, people are really beautiful, if you can look deep enough. Or we all want to be safe and be loved, and we can respond to some positive energy and encouragement, most of us. You'll notice that. Or, wow, it's amazing to be alive. If that's the lens that you notice, that you believe, that you look through, you'll see a lot to confirm your hypothesis. So this is the idea of inclining the mind to notice the good, not to deny the dukkha. Dukkha is a word for suffering, I'm sure most of you know. I've been teaching Buddhist meditation for a long time. I'm well aware, the first noble truth, there is suffering in life. Believe me, I haven't overlooked that. There is suffering in life, but the Buddha didn't say all of life is suffering. And remember, he was called the happy one. So this is not about pretending that everything is okay. It's really seeing the whole package and not just going for the suffering, as most of us tend to do, but to see the whole show. As in Taoism, it's talked about the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. If you only focus on the sorrows, it gets very depressing. If you only focus on the joys, you're living in denial. So you want to be able to open up to the whole, all of life. And people who have found somehow the secrets of well-being and happiness, they're not happy all the time. Happy people are not happy all the time. If somebody says, oh yes, I'm happy all the time, they're either completely living in denial and self-deception, or their jaw is locked and they don't know how to just kind of take it easy a bit. No, truly happy people feel their losses, their pain, have fear, have sadness, have all the things that make life deepen our character, but they're not overwhelmed by them. And they don't miss out on all the good. They see all the blessings and all the beauty and all the goodness and the truth in life. And so every moment counts. And one of the things that we'll be exploring, lest you are concerned this might be a little bit too California for you, awakening joy, we'll be looking at how opening up to the dukkha, opening up to suffering, is actually one of the most important pathways to joy and well-being. This is right out of the Buddha's teaching. In fact, when the Buddha was asked what he spoke of, what he taught, he said, I teach about suffering and the end of suffering. And so being willing to take a look at suffering and not be afraid of it, one can come to the end of suffering. But one can also use suffering as a deepening of understanding of life that actually leads to joy. I realize I should have had some water here. Anybody? Is there anybody? No, you don't. You're not supposed to bring in your water. Okay. Okay. All of a sudden, I just got dry. Suffering. So, happy people, as I said, are not happy all the time. but they are opening up to all of experience. And I want to just share one more thing in case, particularly being aware that you're here, that I'm here in Israel, there are lots of reasons to be affected by the suffering around us. I live in America. There's lots of reasons to be affected by the suffering there. We have a lot of craziness and insanity in my country these days. And so the thought that comes to some people is awakening joy. How can I let myself experience joy and happiness and well-being when there's so much suffering around, when there's so much pain, so much sorrow, so much tension, so much dukkha? Is it okay to let myself feel well-being and joy? One person at one Awakening Joy course raised his hand and he said, are you kind of telling us to sit around and be singing Kumbaya together? You know the song, someone singing Lord Kumbaya. It's a lovely song, but that's not the whole show. And I called it the Kumbaya factor. No, this is really important to understand how you don't want to turn your back on suffering, and really you want to make a difference. Oh, thank you very much. You want to make a difference in this world. And I wanted to read a passage to you that I included in the book that really points to this. This is from a well-respected historian, Howard Zinn, who passed away a few years ago. He's, for those who know Jon Kabat-Zinn from MBSR, he's John's father-in-law. He died a few years ago, Howard did. And he wrote a book called The People's History of the United States, the not whitewashed history, the real full picture, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the beautiful. And this is what he says. This is from an essay that he wrote called The Optimism of Uncertainty. He says, an optimist isn't necessarily a blithe, kind of airy-fairy, slightly sappy, syrupy, whistler in the dark of our time. Oh, it's all okay. To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. But if we remember those times and places, and there are so, so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending this spinning top of a world in a different direction. So it's not to pretend that everything is okay, but to see that there's so much goodness in this world. As one wise friend says, I often share this line, he says, we're in a race between fear and consciousness. And in the end, consciousness is much stronger than fear. But there's a lot of fear and anger and hatred and greed in this world that has tremendous power and forces. And there's never been as much consciousness as there is now in this world. Never. And so we're all agents of consciousness. And what we do, the more we can see that there's goodness in life and it's worth living and it's worth protecting and caring this planet and everyone in it, all living beings in it, the more we are awakening that in others as well. So your own well-being, your own awakening of joy or of goodness or of love becomes a kind of agent to help awaken that in others. Because it's in all of us. We've just forgotten when we get confused and do stupid things or hurtful things. So this, I want you to understand that, or hopefully see that what we're doing here isn't just so I can feel good and feel nice, but you can turn all of your confusion and pain and fear into understanding and compassion and wisdom, not just for yourself, but for everyone in your life. We all do want to be happy. Anybody here that doesn't want to be happy? And if you're somebody who's saying, well, if I'm really honest, I'd raise my hand and say, I like being grumpy. That's just your way of being happy. Whatever turns you on. But if you take a look, you'll see that everything that you do, don't take my word for it, take a look, everything you do is motivated by some sense that this will make me feel a little bit better, or this will make me feel a little less bad. It can often be misguided, often misguided. And so you do something saying, oh, this will feel so good. And then after, what was I thinking? Okay. But it's coming from a place in you that really wants to be happy. So this is what we're doing here, is just activating and getting in touch with that place that really is wanting that well-being, and then seeing where well-being truly can be found and just activating it and deepening it. But your true nature is one of well-being, and I'll share with you, I shared this picture on the weekend, some of you saw. Just to, in case you forget who you really are, I want you to meet Chloe Thomas, who from Melbourne, Australia, who was born 8 weeks premature, and this picture was taken when she wasn't quite 9 months after conception. But this is a good picture of showing who you really are. Meet Chloe. I don't know if you can see it in the back. Do you remember? That was you. No, that wasn't me. Yeah, it was you. Coming into this world, if you are fed and your diapers are changed and you get a little bit of love, this is your true nature. We've forgotten, or it can get obscured or covered over. But this is who we really are. That's why the Buddha said, oh yes, find out who you, what your true nature is, there's goodness and love and peace right in there. And in case you think, oh, well, that's just babies, actually, if you put an adult in an fMRI machine and that adult doesn't have pain in their body or emotional stress, those are two big things, I grant you. If they're not under any stress, what they exhibit hooked up to the electrodes, they are conscious, calm, creative, caring, and content. That's your true nature. You might say, well, that's been a long time since I felt those. It's right in there waiting to be remembered. And so that's why what we're doing here, the practice, is so profound. Just like the Buddha said, cultivating wholesome states, and then when they're here, to maintain and increase them. And those wholesome states happen to be the conditions out of which, when the wholesome states are ripened and mature, particularly the seven factors of awakening, but all of them, he says, cultivate these wholesome states because they are the ground out of which the deepest kind of freedom comes. So what we'll be doing, just to explain, using those three principles and applying them to 10, I don't know if we'll get to do all of them, try to, 10 different wholesome states of the Buddha's teachings, that these are ones that are, you know, central to the teachings that I saw, oh, if we cultivate this state consciously, and then we are present for it when there's a moment of well-being, then we are deepening our inclination of the mind towards happiness. Now, I want to warn you, I'm almost finished. You've been really patient so far. It's a long day. Don't try hard to be joyful. It doesn't work. People have said, I am really trying hard to be joyful, and this is just exhausting. No. You don't have to try to make anything happen. All you need to do is be authentically right where you are, feel an alive connection with your experience, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, doesn't matter. And out of that presence and connection, there's a kind of aliveness that is really the invitation to well-being. And the key, as you probably can guess, is mindfulness. As the Buddha says in the Satipatthana Sutta, he says, there is a most direct way to overcome sorrow, lamentation, and grief, despair, pain, and anxiety, and realize the highest happiness, and that is the establishment of mindfulness. So mindfulness itself, as we'll see as the retreat goes on, is the key to developing wholesome states, and when they're here, when you are mindful of them, they become strengthened and deepened. Don't have to be anywhere other than where you are. Don't try to make anything happen. Here's just one little extra credit assignment that I'll be reminding you throughout the retreat. If you happen to be experiencing a moment of ease or well-being, or you're not miserable, oh, not miserable now. Or you're just saying, well, it's okay. Okay is okay, by the way. Don't miss it. Don't miss it and notice, oh, this is a moment of well-being. And there's a difference between thinking, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good now, and just one little additional tweak, oh, this is what it feels like to feel good. We don't usually go that far. Oh, this is what well-being feels like. Not grasping it, just not missing it, savoring it. And when it's gone, it's gone. It's okay. Okay. So, we're on this adventure together. Be right where you are. The Dharma will give you just what you need. Trust in it. Let go of the agenda or program. And let's support each other in going through this. It's amazingly good karma that we're all here together to support each other for this week. Isn't that truly amazing? Think of everything that had to happen, the people perhaps that supported you in coming here, or the circumstances in life that have brought you here. And here we all are together just to support each other in deepening our practice, our kindness, our understanding, and our joy. So let's just sit for a moment before we end. Thank you very much for your kind attention. So it's about 1:45.